This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. We are ready to discuss the important events of the week. We have our panel here in the studio and online. In the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
We have Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
And via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start by talking about the internet and the possibility that it might actually change forever. President Obama seems determined to hand control of the internet over to an international agency before the coming U.S. presidential election. This is a story with significant implications, and we're going to learn about it by going to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, what's happening here, I think, is a small step in what is a huge story. You know, we don't tend to think about the nuts and bolts of what goes on in the background of the internet, who controls a lot of that. It just is there, and it works, and it has worked ever since the internet has been here, and we just always assume it's going to keep going. So what is happening here is that the Obama administration is getting ready to hand over control of the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority to a group called ICANN. We'll get into ICANN a bit later, but what this does is give up American control over this organization. Now, IANA, they have always worked for ICANN, but before it's been under a contract that the U.S. government renews that they could cancel. Now they're giving that up. So they are giving up power over this organization, power over what they do. So what does this organization do?
That was my exact question, Richard. What does this organization do?
It's something that I said is a little technical, but it's not complex. It's fairly straightforward to understand. Computers speak numbers. Humans don't. Google.com is a lot easier to remember than 213.105.64.251. If that is what you had to remember to go and do a Google search, you would never do a Google search. You wouldn't be able to remember anywhere close to the huge numbers of websites that we use. And so there is a system for translating websites as we know them, thetrumpet.com, google.com, facebook.com, into these numbers that computers can use and work with. And at a very high level, this organization, the IANA, runs that system. And so they're exiting U.S. government control. Now, this is very important because this is exactly the system that authorities tend to use to block websites. And it's one of the best ways there is for controlling the internet. You know, the internet partly came about because of Defense Department's efforts to build a communications network that could survive a nuclear war. So it's something that's very robust. And so that becomes then a challenge. How do you take a website down? Well, one of the easiest ways to do it is to break the system that takes the human readable friendly name, google.com, into numbers. And so you may remember a few years ago, SOPAPIPA was a big deal. Lots of websites were going dark in protest against it because it would allow censorship, they said. And the way that this act would have censored websites is it would have forced internet companies to break that link so that when you went to, say, google.com, it would no longer point you to the correct sequence of numbers. And unless you could happen to remember those numbers, you would not be able to go to the website. The IANA, what they're handing over, if you were to try and use that to do that kind of thing, it's quite a blunt instrument. You would end up there would be a lot of collateral damage if you tried to use that to block websites. It's not necessarily the preferred way of doing it. But it's still a very powerful tool, something very important for controlling the internet. And now America is giving that over to this organization called ICANN.
So a couple of questions. First of all, do we have any sense of what is motivating President Obama to make this move? What's precipitating it? Is it criticism from other nations about American control over this, and he's acquiescing to that?
Yes, that's a very big part of it. And I think it's the larger trend that this is a part of that makes it so significant, because after the NSA, the spying scandal, before then, a lot of people didn't really, in terms of general public, didn't really have a huge concern about America running a lot of this kind of backbone of the internet. Russia and China and authoritarian regimes, they resented it, but it wasn't an issue for ordinary people. Then it turns out that America has been abusing or at least using this control that it has to spy on people, to track people. And so there's a big global movement saying, well, we need to get this away from America so they can't abuse that power and use this against us. And this is just one part of that movement. So ICANN, for example, the organization that controls it, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, they are hugely important, this one that they've been transferred to. And there is a major push to give that up to the United Nations. It's not something that has happened right now, but I imagine what would happen if that did. Russia and China, authoritarian regimes, they sit on the United Nations and they have a veto power. And so you start to get now, we are moving down the path that would allow some of these authoritarian regimes to shut down websites. And it's not just Russia and China to worry about. I mean, even Europe has a fundamentally different concept of freedom of speech to America. America is almost unique in terms of its first amendment. Even Britain, I mean, we have some very strong freedom of speech laws. We don't have a First Amendment. That view and that dedication to freedom of speech, I don't know of any country in the world that has that same dedication. And if you look at the European Union, they passed laws to make it so that Google had to not list Google search results that people didn't like about themselves. They have a fundamentally different view of information on the internet. And so when you start opening that up to multilateral bodies, which is what this process is a part of, you start to get a picture of a very different internet.
So is there a sense, you mentioned that that there's been a push to turn this over to the United Nations. Is that what is happening? This article that we have in the Trumpet Weekly talks about the fact that the Department of Commerce is set to hand off the final vestiges of American control over the internet to international authorities. Do we have a sense of what those international authorities would be composed of, and any kind of a sense based on what they've done in the past as to the kinds of changes that we would see?
Well, ICANN is a private charity registered in California. So I'd say what this is it represents a step away from American government direct control over the internet. Now, because ICANN is a private charity, its relationship in relation to the US government get very quickly, very quickly. It's based in America, but it's not controlled by America. It also has offices around the world. It has an advisory council that does contain people from around the world. Nothing much has changed in terms of how ICANN has run. So if things were to remain exactly as they were, I don't think there'd necessarily be a huge danger here of other countries getting that control. But there was already, it was called the Montevideo Statement on the Future of the Internet in 2013. All the same forces that pushed this to happen, the IANA to go over to ICANN, are pushing now for ICANN to go to the United Nations. So it's moving in this direction. The danger is, where will it go further now?
And this is really the criticism that is being lodged by opponents of this move, that are saying that essentially you're handing the reins of this communication tool over to potentially totalitarian governments that could shut down different websites and prevent the free exchange of information.
That's exactly it. Though the other interesting point that I think the Inquirer mentioned is that they wrote, it's no coincidence that all this was done and dusted before the forthcoming US elections. Imagine Donald Trump in charge of the internet. So I also think there's a growing fear as well that the US might start to take a more restrictive or authoritarian view of freedom of speech as well. And there's the potential for a threat from that direction too.
It doesn't surprise me when you just look at, say, measurements of freedom of expression and freedom across the globe, political freedom. It is diminishing in a lot of different areas, and there is a lot more totalitarian influence in a lot of nations. It's on the rise, and it shouldn't really surprise us that this is happening with respect to what is arguably the freest sort of the Wild West of communication in the world, that would be under threat as well. And it certainly has huge implications for, outfits like ours that mm-hmm. heavily uses the internet and really has no restrictions of what we're able to post. It enables us to reach audiences around the world free of any restrictions at all, and there could be a point where that would change. Well, we appreciate you bringing that to us, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. We're going to turn now to some geopolitical developments. The war in Syria continues this week. The tragedy unfolding there was dramatically illustrated by some video of a boy in Aleppo sitting in the back of an ambulance, bloodied and dazed after an airstrike by the Assad regime. A lot of people are asking what can be done. Interesting development this past Tuesday when Russia began launching airstrikes against Islamist extremists in Syria from a base in Iran. This was a couple of firsts. The first time Russia had used a base from a nation other than Syria in its anti-terror campaign in the Middle East, and the first time Iran allowed another nation to use its territory for military operations since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. To learn more about this, we will turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, these bombers that normally take off from Russian territory, I guess the airfields inside Syria, they're too big for these bombers. They're quite large. They're the Tupolev 22M3 long-range bombers. And instead of taking 1,200 miles a trip of that distance, now they can reach Syria with just a 400-mile trip. So there is that element to this that it does make it easier for the Russians to attack, but it is Syria, but it also just shows how much this alliance of convenience, I believe, is growing with Iran, to the point that they would allow them to break this 37-year-old precedent that they have, that they're not going to allow foreign countries to use their nation as a staging ground for any type of military actions. So it's something very interesting that we think about, especially in relation to the nuclear deal that went down. The United States probably would have liked that opportunity. Obviously, that sounds ridiculous, but they're the ones that kind of, you know, worked out this deal so they could smooth over relations with Iran. And yet Russia seems to be the great beneficiary of Iran's movement into the West, if we could call it that. And now they're flying their bombers from their territory.
Now, maybe you could just give us a sense of what's in it for Russia and what's in it for Iran to have this kind of cooperation.
Well, it's interesting. For Iran, I don't see too much that they can actually gain from this. I think that Russia does have greater leverage over Iran for the future of Syria, because Iran needs a air force to support the Assad regime, or else they're going to lose sway with Assad and lose power out of that. So they need Russia to be bombing Syria. So that probably, you know, Russia probably said, can we use your territory, and or else maybe they were going to do something else. We know that they already had arranged to send and have sent some of these S-300 air defense systems to Iran. Russia has supplied them with those. And maybe there's going to be future defense deals coming out. But I see more of this benefiting Russia more than it benefiting Iran. And not just because it's, you know, cutting down on the journey. It really puts Russia in a far stronger position in the Middle East than they've been in for decades. We know that the United States is normally the one, and even we've written about that historically over the past 30 years, that's dominated the Middle East. And yet we even wrote last year about Russia and how they were moving in. Remember, they just started fighting in Syria back last year, And that was just shocking to the world. And now they're creeping. They're jumping over Iraq, and they're going all the way to Iran to expand their influence. These flyovers are going to have to go over Iraqi territory to get into Syria. Well, they have been. Those skies are normally belong to the United States over Iraq. But now you're going to have Russian bombers flying over there en route to Syria. I also feel like this was more of a political move for Putin, in the sense that he can now push his reach all the way from Syria and even into Turkey, when you consider the relations that they've got lately, through Syria, into Iraq, down into Iran. And I just like to quote from Callum Wood's article. This is going up, I believe it's on Sunday, and he calls it, entitles it, Russia and Iran, the Middle East Axis of Evil. And that was what Time Magazine called this new axis, Russia, Syria, and Iran. But Callum Wood writes this. He says, the sway of the battle in Syria is no longer the prerogative of America, but Russia. Iran, the nation that Obama has sought to cozy up to over the course of his presidency, now breaks from multi-decade-long norms to accommodate the wishes of Russia, not America. And then he says, for Putin, the ability to operate out of Iran is a major political victory as the Kremlin attempts to establish itself as a viable alternative to America. That's what he's doing here. He's announced fully that if you're going to want to deal in the skies over the central part of the Middle East, the Fertile Crescent, you're going to have to deal with Russia first and talk to Russia first, not the United States.
And it seems like that's really underlined by the fact that the United States was so unhappy about this, and the response that Russia had against American protests was quite forceful.
Yeah, they basically said that they can butt out of it. But what's interesting as well is they were meant to discuss this with the United States under their agreement before they bombed any target in Syria, and especially before they flew over Iraq. And they did, but it was just moments before that they took off. So Russia, they're on the surface and through the diplomatic talk, they say they're willing to work with the United States to produce a diplomatic solution in Syria. And then they go ahead behind the United States back, really, and go further than they've ever gone before at bombing these targets in Syria. It is interesting as well. This wasn't the only new thing to happen this week. Just yesterday, the Syrian Kurds were bombed by the Assad regime for the first time in the Syrian civil war. Now, the Syrian Air Force doesn't do this without Russia saying, yes, go ahead and do that. And the YPG, or the Syrian Kurds, they are the main helper of the United States, the main ally of the United States in Syria, in the war against the Islamic State. And yet the Syrian regime, with the backing of Russia, also bombed them this week for the first time.
Well, I'm sure that these developments are raising eyebrows in European capitals as well. While we're on the subject of Syria, another development this week, when China announced on Thursday that it would get involved in the conflict. This is a move that could certainly affect the outcome of this war. And for this, we'll turn to Jeremiah.
Yes. One of China's highest ranking military officials said that China will be providing both military training and humanitarian aid for the army of Assad. So China has long said that it shares Russia's view that Assad remains the legitimate ruler of Syria. And China has always joined Moscow in blocking any UN resolutions that are critical of the Assad regime. And really, that should come as no surprise, because ever since the Western world attempted to ostracize Vladimir Putin's Russia for its annexation of Crimea back in 2014, Russia and China have been forging an even deeper partnership. And a big part of that has been in supporting each other's expansionistic efforts. So when China builds and militarizes its artificial islands in the South China Sea in order to strengthen its claims to those territories, Russia supports it. And then when China says that Taiwan is an integral part of China's territory and that there's really only one China, Russia backs that up. And so now in the Syrian dispute, it's China's turn to back Russia. Russia, of course, supports the regime in Syria, but it's not really because of any special love that Putin has for Assad. It's because, as Brent discussed, Assad's regime has really allowed Russia to establish a major military presence on Syrian soil that it can use to project its power into the Middle East. Primarily, we see that in the naval facility in Tartus, right there on the Mediterranean coast. That's incredibly valuable to Russia. This base allows Russia to project all of its power into the Middle East, which we're seeing in recent months at unprecedented levels. And so much of that is, as Brent said, at the expense of U.S. power in the region. And the base also allows Russia to project power into the Mediterranean Sea, which history affirms is just of really vital geostrategic importance. So there's a lot at stake for Russia in the Syrian civil war, and that's why the Russians have thrown their support behind Assad. Russia often says that it's fighting the Islamic State, but really it's much more focused on preserving Assad's regime. They just want to ensure that nobody comes into power that could potentially kick the Russians out of Syria. And so now China is basically in there repaying its obligations to Russia to a degree. It's throwing its weight behind that same regime. And I think it's interesting because normally China leaves Middle Eastern diplomacy to the other permanent members of the UN Security Council. Even though China gets about 50% of its oil imports from the Middle East. But now, somewhat suddenly, China is getting pretty deeply involved in the world's most volatile and dangerous region.
So pretty strong evidence of just how strong and strengthening the relationship between Russia and China is becoming for it to be throwing its weight behind the Russian position in this very tense conflict. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. We're going to talk now about the migrant crisis. We were speaking in last week's Week in Review about how this is a problem that is not going away. The numbers of migrants going into Europe continue to rise, yet the response by Germany's chancellor is remarkably out of step with that reality. And for this, we will go back to Richard.
Yes, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has said, well, she said that the phenomenon of Islamist terrorism, of Islamic State, is not a phenomenon that came to us with refugees. So she's trying to argue that the terrorist attacks that happened in Germany, that they're not related to her refugee policy, that terrorism is not related to the vast number of migrants. And then she went on from that, and she also said that Islam, as long as it respects the German constitution and German values, Islam has a place in Germany. And I think what's interesting about what she's saying is that it is out of step with what most Germans think. So if there was a poll back in, I think it was March, May, but this was before the recent attacks, before that week where you had just several attacks within Germany, and 60% of Germans in that poll, and it was a pretty comprehensive poll, I think they polled around 1,000 people, 60% said Islam has no place in Germany. So you've
and
got
a view
the,
that
the
would have only intensified after those attacks occurred.
Right, exactly. And I'm not sure how many did not give an answer. Here we go. And then only 34% said Islam has a place in Germany. So when the German chancellor stands up and says Islam has a place in Germany, only a third of Germans agree with her in that. And that was back in May, so quite possibly even less now. So you're starting to see a real difference in what Angela Merkel is saying and what the people believe.
And just quickly, what this might lead to. We've been talking about the demise of Angela Merkel for a long time, but at some point something's got to give here.
Right, and if you look at who is saying what the people agree with, what the 60% or probably more that said that Islam doesn't have a place in Germany. I mean, look at German politics. Angela Merkel, all for immigrants. The SDP, more pro-migrant, more likely to support Islam than Angela Merkel is. The Left Party, exactly the same. Green Party, the same. So you're starting to get to, and unless you live in Bavaria, you have to support the Alternative for Deutschland, this kind of stigmatized fringe right-wing party, if you want to find someone who agrees with your views. And so it's pushing now Germany away from these established parties, away from even the established way of doing politics. And it's forcing them, because they have no other choice, really, if they want someone who's going to help deal with this real threat. It's forcing them, and I think reluctantly, but it's forcing them into the right, into the arms of these fringe right-wing elements. And it's just going to make them desperate, more desperate for a different type of leader.
Very troubling and very, very significant trend that we're seeing there. We appreciate that, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We'll have one more story before a break. Now that we're finished with Richard's segment, let's talk about British politics. The move to the left that we see happening in American politics right now is also happening in Britain. And for a look at some telling developments within the Labour Party in particular, we'll turn to Andrew.
Right. Well, Brexit has obviously changed a lot of things in Britain, and the Labour Party's had a real tough few months. I mean, even before Brexit, they had this big scandal where several of their MPs had made anti-Semitic comments that had tarnished their image, and then they supported the Remain camp and that lost the Brexit vote. And so they're really trailing the Conservative Party right now. And I guess their solution they've come up with that is how to get more public support is they need to track even further to the left. There was a no-confidence vote. They were trying to get rid of the Labour Party leader, Jeremy Corbyn, and he lost the no-confidence vote, but he stayed anyway. So he's definitely says staying leader, but he can't.
And just so we're up to speed, tell us about Jeremy Corbyn and how left this man is to begin with.
Right, yeah. Because to begin with, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn's the type of guy that about makes Senator Bernie Sanders here in America look like a capitalist sellout. Because it's, I mean, he's publicly referred to in the past of like Hamas and Hezbollah as potential friends of Britain. He's publicly praised the economic policy of the late Venezuelan dictator Hugo Chavez. He appointed a communications officer to his party who's publicly gone on record saying that Joseph Stalin isn't as bad as people say he was.
So what we're seeing now is actually tracking further to the left?
Well, I guess you might not go further left. You'd get harder to get much further left than that unless, like, Mikhail Gorbachev was running. But there is still a divide, like within the Democratic Party in the United States, there's still a divide in the Labour Party between this further left wing that Corbyn represents and then a little more vestiges of like the old like Tony Blair, Gordon Brown coalition. And so this coming September, they're going to have a new general conference to determine who's going to be the new leader of the Labour Party. Jeremy Corbyn's running, but Owen Smith is also running. He's normally would be kind of like the leader of the more moderate part of the Labour Party, but similar to in America where we saw Hillary Clinton become much further left than she was in the 90s in order to try to cater to the Sanders wing of her party. You're seeing the same thing where Owen Smith, he might not be going further left than Jeremy Corbyn, but he's definitely realizing that I'm going to have to become further left than I've been in the past if I'm going to have a shot at winning this nomination.
The Trumpet Weekly quotes a Wall Street Journal article that describes some of Owen's move in that direction. Maybe you could give us some specifics.
Right. Well, that's kind of the news peg for this week is that on Wednesday he made a comment, which he may end up regretting, but it definitely shows the direction he's going to, where he was talking about the crisis in Syria, and he says that we need to sit down and negotiate with all the different factions in Syria, including ISIS.
Negotiating with
Islamic
ISIS.
State. So he's like, so say any political solution in Syria, we're going to have to negotiate with the Islamic State, which shows that, I mean, Corbyn got enough flack for a couple years ago when he said that, well, we need to negotiate with Hezbollah or Hamas. And then it's just kind of this move where now Owen's like, says, well, I'm just as radical as Corbyn is. You can vote for me. It's like, says, he wants to vote for Hamas. He's like, I'll do him one better and let's negotiate with ISIS.
Richard, you have any comment on this skewering of British politics here?
It's almost what would happen to the Democratic Party if Bernie Sanders won. It's a similar phenomenon in that a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters weren't longtime Democrats, and Bernie Sanders himself has always run as an independent, and so there's a lot of that behind it. I think a lot of Jeremy Corbyn, one of the big mistakes the Labour Party made is they let people join the Labour Party for £3 and vote for a leader. And so a bunch of people who used to be Green Party members and weren't longtime Labour members joined the Labour Party. and voted for Jeremy Corbyn. But he is seriously popular, and he's seriously popular among people that are very energized into politics. I think it shows how polarized things have become. And I think every day it seems like it's looking more and more likely that the people, you know, the Hillary Clinton type people, the Blairites, and even the ones that you wouldn't call Blairites, but just not quite as far extreme as Jeremy Corbyn, it looks like they may well have to split and form another party. And that might be the only way they could get rid of Corbyn, which is just astonishing that he has that much support among I don't think he has that much support among the general public, but among people who are really passionate about politics.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure like Theresa May and the Conservative Party wouldn't mind that so much. If they had the Labour Party split down the middle, I guess they wouldn't have much of a chance of winning any elections for the next few years if that were to happen.
Well, we appreciate that, gents. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about the vulnerability of America's nuclear weapons in Turkey, Germany arming the Kurds, China's efforts to reclaim land on its own coastline, and an explosion of race-related violence in Milwaukee. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Are America's nuclear weapons secure? A lot of stories have come out in recent years saying no, they are alarmingly insecure and vulnerable. And this past week, one report specifically pointed to America's nuclear arsenal based in Turkey and has said that they were especially susceptible to hostile forces in that country. For this, we will go back to Jerusalem to Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, this report that came out earlier this week from a Washington think tank, it's called the Simpson Center, sorry, and they're not really affiliated with any party. They're a pretty neutral think tank, and they just discussed the risk that the weapons, the 50-plus nuclear weapons U.S. nuclear weapons that are stationed at the Incirlik Air Base in Syria, the risk of them being able to be captured by terrorists or other hostile forces. And they kind of deduced that it would kind of be a toss of the dice whether under a type of situation we saw a couple of weeks ago when Turkey or the army in Turkey or military tried to take over the government there, if that happens again for an extended period of time, whether or not those nuclear weapons would – or what would happen to them, whether the United States would be able to secure them or not. It's interesting, during that coup in July, the Incirlik's power was cut. The Turkish government prohibited any U.S. airplanes from flying out. They were grounded. They had to be stationed there. And then eventually the base commander was arrested and then implicated in the coup. The base commander of where, 50-plus United States nukes are held. So it's a little bit risky, apparently, according to this think tank. And then also this week, there are a couple of independent sources that reported to youractive.com that the United States has actually started to transfer some of this weaponry out of Incirlik Air Base, moving it to Eastern Europe, which is very interesting when you consider what Putin has said about the United States and their defensive position, I guess, on Russia's frontier. So I don't know whether that's true. Romania has denied the reports that the nukes have been sent there. But the United States was, according to these sources, quite upset with the way that with the situation during the coup and their inability to fly out of Incirlik, their inability really to fly out their own nukes from that country. And they might be taking actions to move them out themselves now.
The fracturing of the U.S.-Turkey relationship is something that we have talked about in the past as being prophetically significant. And this certainly is a strong indication of just how fragile that relationship is. And you could see Turkey really taking exception to what America is doing there. But given the coup, given the instability politically in that country, any number of things could happen. You could see that those nukes really are something that we need to keep an eye on, not to mention the American nukes even in Europe and elsewhere that have been proven to be insecure as well. We appreciate that, Brent. We're going to turn now to Richard. Reports came out this week that the German army delivered a huge shipment of weapons to Kurdish Peshmerga fighters in Iraq. And Richard will put this in context for us and show us why it's significant.
So Germany stopped sending weapons to the Peshmerga forces earlier in the year. I think it was back in January. But they sent 70 tons of weaponry, 1,500 assault rifles, 100 anti-tank missiles, 3 armored vehicles. Now, the German military support mission to the Kurds, I think, is very significant because it really breaks the last taboos on the German military. I mean, we covered this on the website at the time. It was the first time, as the article we have in the Trumpet points out, that Germany was supplying weapons to an active war zone. It was the first time that Germany was supplying weapons to a non-state actor. Germany is training Kurdish forces, and that is continuing, and they'll presumably be training them in these weapons. And that was really significant when they first started doing that. The German constitution, at first, after the war, people believed that this meant that the German army could only be used to defend the homeland. In 1994, the Supreme Court watered that down and said that it could be deployed abroad if the German parliament approved and if it was part of some kind of collective security arrangement, so say as part of NATO or responding to a United Nations mission. The mission to support the Kurds, again, led to a watering down of that restriction to the point that it's almost irrelevant. One argument is the German constitution said the forces can only be used for defense, but it doesn't say defense of Germany, and that therefore Germany can use these armed forces in defense of anyone, anywhere. Another argument says that it's fine because there was a UN resolution on the subject of Syria, not calling for a military mission, but it was on the same subject. And while there may not be a formal collective security arrangement, there are allies. And if those are your criteria, the war has to be in defense of someone, or there has to be a UN resolution on the same subject, and there have to be allies. You know, nothing is off limits.
Mm-hmm.
Anything can be justified. So they did shut this supply mission down when it was rumored that, or when the Süddeutsche Zeitung had evidence that some of these weapons were getting onto the black market. They're confident that they've stopped now, and they're moving again full steam ahead with this supply mission to the Kurds.
Well, so there's certainly a very strong angle in this story of just the continual tumbling of these prohibitions against German military mm-hmm. action. There's also just the aspect of the fact that it's the Kurds that they're arming here, and how does that affect politics within Iraq? How does that change the balance of power in the Middle East?
True. I do think their efforts are... I mean, if you're comparing what Germany's doing to, say, what Russia is doing, it's not quite on the same scale. However, it's certainly going to lead Germany to becoming more involved in the Middle East. And I think it also, more importantly, it's bringing their diplomatic weight and heft. I think they're a very well-respected nation. Everyone knows they practically head up the EU. Even Vladimir Putin, I think, listens when Germany speaks, and they're now calling for a ceasefire within Syria. And I think that could be very significant now if you start seeing Germany become more politically involved in the region, because at the moment I think they're a huge political power, and they're just now, their military is kind of just starting to catch up with that.
Well, we appreciate that, Richard. We do need to keep our eyes on that, because just the relationship between the Kurds, the Iraqis, and the Iranians, I think, is a situation that will is extremely important prophetically. And the fact that Germany, I mean, I'm just thinking about this in terms of what Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has written about Germany's efforts to encircle Iran, or to at least put some kind of a curb on Iranian ambition. And Iraq is certainly a major theater where Iran has shown its ambition within the region. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. We've talked a lot on this program about China's aggressive activities in the South China Sea and the artificial islands that it's building there in order to project its power. That isn't the only land reclamation project that China is undertaking. To learn about others, we will go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, as significant as those island-building projects are, there was a new report that came out this week that said the vast majority of Beijing's land reclamation is happening right off the coasts of mainland China. There was a team of researchers that published satellite imagery that tracked those changes in China's coastline starting all the way back in 1985. So it's about a 30-year time frame that they were analyzing. And they found that in that time frame, China has reclaimed more than 2,970 square miles of land from coastal wetlands. So that's a staggering amount of land, really. It adds up to an area larger than Delaware and Rhode Island combined. And it's all being completely industrialized. China's economy has undergone really rapid growth since 1985, the start period of this study, and a great deal of its urbanization and industrialization has been concentrated in those coastal regions. China also has very strict laws that protect arable farmland from being developed. So that just makes developers focus even more on these coastal areas. So geopolitically, I think this is significant. It's just one more really powerful piece of evidence showing China's determination to grow stronger and more powerful and quite literally larger. But it also has some pretty sobering environmental implications. China is the world's most polluting country by far. It releases more than 10 million kilotons, I think it is, of CO2 emissions every year. And I think most of us have seen the photos of people in Shanghai and Beijing when the smog is just so thick that you can't see more than a few feet in front of you. And this broad-scale transformation of lush wetlands into coal-fueled cities on the coasts is just really exacerbating that trend.
Well, definitely, for this to have been going on for as long as it is, you just wonder how much of this economic rise that we've seen in China is associated with this urbanization and this industrialization of the development that you're describing here. It really does give you a vivid picture of just how determined China is to race to the top, the ambitions that it has both as a nation and globally. Very interesting picture there. We appreciate you bringing that to us. We're going to conclude this segment with a story that we can't have the program, The Week in Review, without talking about this. But as we were talking before we came on the air, this kind of story has become pretty routine. Some serious race problems that showed themselves up in the Milwaukee area this past week. And for this story, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, well, it definitely is sad that it seems like we're doing this once a month or more often. But there was another big race riot broke out in Milwaukee last Saturday night and Sunday night. I think probably about one person killed in the riotings, but maybe a dozen arrested. And then so six or seven buildings, including a gas station, that were burnt down. It's a little different and probably hard for some people to get their minds wrapped around is some of the past race riots they've had, like the one in Ferguson, were actually when a white officer shot an unarmed black man. This is actually a black police officer shooting an armed black a black man armed with a gun he'd stolen and threatened the officer with. So it was, I think I saw one of the articles summarizing it, saying it was a black officer shooting a black criminal in a majority black neighborhood, and yet the riots were still over white racism.
Yeah, it's remarkable. But, yeah, I mean, it really does expose the how they're using these kinds of incidents as a pretext for a predetermined agenda.
Right. Well, they had the leader of the new Black Panther Party weigh in on this about how this isn't just a riot, this is a war, and it's war because the blacks are being killed in the area. And he didn't address directly the claim that it was a black officer shooting a black man who threatened him with a gun. But it does, when you look at like the ideology of the new Black Panthers, I think by way of analogy, the thing that came to my mind is back in the 1960s, there was a Marxist feminist thinker who made the claim, Catherine McKinnon was her name, who made the claim that all sex between a man and a wife in marriage was by definition rape, because the institution of marriage was designed to oppress women so that way there couldn't be a consensual sexual relationship within marriage. And when you look at the comments from the new Black Panthers, it really does kind of use that same ideology in the fact that the claim is that since they're taking it as for granted that the power structure in America is white, all killings of blacks is a result of that power structure. It doesn't matter if the individual officer who did it was white or black or whatever color. If you're working for a government that they assume is a white supremacist, that's just details whether what color the police officer who did the shooting was.
It's hard to reason with a mind that has grabbed hold of that kind of thinking. We appreciate that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we talk about on this program, we combine them all into a single document along with a whole lot of other stories. And you can really get a good overview of the important events of the week by subscribing to The Trumpet Weekly. You can receive it in your email inbox every Friday. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round. All our panelists will have one more chance to weigh in on some headlines that caught their attention. That's coming up next.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll see how many headlines we can hit in the next 5 or 6 minutes, and we'll start with Richard.
Germany's interior minister said just today that face coverings are not part of Germany's open society. He did acknowledge that a complete ban would be unconstitutional, but he said he was looking for ways to put a ban in place in certain areas. So not all of Germany obviously agrees with the approach Angela Merkel is taking on this, and so we could see some laws clamping down on certain parts of Islam within Germany soon.
All right, let's go now to Andrew.
Yeah, there were 99 people shot in Chicago last week, which is a new record for the city, bringing the total number killed at the end of that week up to 800 more than there were last year, a total of 2,500 victims. And so it is true that while U.S. murder rates have hit their lowest levels in 50 years nationwide, the murder rate in individual cities like Chicago is the highest it's been in two decades.
Let's go now to Jeremiah.
ISIS has claimed responsibility for its first terror attack in Russia. This happened just yesterday on a motorway in Balashikha, that's very near to Moscow, the Russian capital. And there were two men who claimed affiliation with the Islamic State, and they attacked some police officers with two axes and a gun. All of the police officers survived the attack, but one of them is in serious condition right now. And meanwhile, the Islamic State released a video of the two attackers pledging their support to the leader of the Islamic State.
All right, back to Richard.
Alexis Tsipras, the Greek leader, has said that he will do whatever is necessary to get more money from Germany. This time he's talking about getting repatriations. The Greeks believe that Germany hasn't properly compensated them for the damage and a major forced loan that they caused and they took from Greece during World War II. And so he's promising now to push very hard to get Germany to give them billions of euros in compensation. Obviously, that's not very popular with Germany. And really, in pushing for this, he's playing with fire and potentially inviting a very strong response from Germany to put this down.
All right, we'll head over to Brent.
Is the EU starting to pit itself up against Russia in Syria? This week, EU Foreign Affairs Chief Federica Mogherini said in a statement that she calls for an immediate halt to the fighting in Aleppo to allow medical evacuations, deliveries of aid, and repairing of essential water and electricity infrastructure. This is the very place that some of those Russian bombers hit that we talked about earlier on in the program. At the same time, in the same statement, she called on all international actors to abide by its commitments that they've already made towards a ceasefire and put that in place. And she's obviously referring to Russia in that. And then finally, she said that the EU believed there could be no peace without a genuine political transition, which is just political talk for meaning that Assad needs to step down at some point and then have a negotiated settlement.
All right, let's go now to Andrew.
Canadians can now grow their own marijuana. This has been a legalization process in the works for the last several months, but on Thursday, Health Canada announced that registered patients who've been prescribed marijuana for medical purposes can now grow it in their own home with a permit.
Back to Jeremiah.
Chinese airlines will need to hire almost 100 pilots every week for the next 20 years if they want to meet the rapidly growing travel demand. Airbus Group SE said on Thursday that the volume of air traffic over China is rapidly growing and it's set to quadruple in the next 20 years. And as of now, they don't have nearly enough pilots to meet this demand. So China's in the market for some pilots.
All right, let's go back to Richard.
In the wake of the attacks in Nice, a lot of French towns on the southern coast there have been making it illegal for women to wear the so-called burkini. This is a type of swimwear that's popular among some Muslim women because it covers them up pretty completely. And I think it's an indication of some of the culture wars now going on in France. It's quite clear that this ban is a reaction to the terrorist attacks, though it's obviously not a security reaction. It's not going to make them any safer. So it's a measure of the level of anger and hostility that's growing against Islam within France.
All right, back to Andrew.
It's been a devastating week for weather. They said in Southern California, wildfire spread and burnt down 47 square miles this week, forcing thousands of people to flee. And then meanwhile, in Louisiana, they had a historic 24 inches of rainfall during the first half of this week, killing 11 people and damaging more than 40,000 homes.
All right, and we'll conclude with Brent.
Last week, an excavation team discovered just 10 centimeters below the peak surface, a peak in the Galilee region of Israel, a synagogue dating from the 1st century AD before the Roman destruction of Judea. Now, there have been other synagogues that have been found in the past from this period, but this is the first one that was discovered outside of a city. It was discovered in an agricultural area, and it turns out in order for the Jews working on this farm to abide by the Jewish custom to not travel more than 1.5 kilometers on the Sabbath day, that they had to build their own synagogue at this farm.
Well, thanks for that, gentlemen. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'd be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. Give us your thoughts on the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Nachtigall.
Great to be
Pleasure
here.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Rupert Hughes. A determined soul will do more with a rusty monkey wrench than a loafer will accomplish with all the tools in a machine shop. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.